Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The U.S. government faces a possible partial shutdown at midnight on Thursday. That after Senate Republicans blocked a spending bill last night that would have kept the government open past September 30th and extended the debt ceiling, which the nation is expected to hit by around late October. Now, here in Massachusetts, a government shutdown could mean thousands of local non-essential federal employees eventually stop getting paid. You got a weekend trip planned to a local national park. It might be closed. So why these looming potential crises? Essentially, it's a battle for leverage on infrastructure, and that may not seem like a very sexy word, but $1 trillion for roads and bridges and $3.5 trillion in social spending for everything from kids to climate hang in the balance. Now, resolving all that is what is on the work-to-do list for Congresswoman Catherine Clark this week. She represents Massachusetts' 5th District and is the Assistant Speaker of the House. She joins us now. Congresswoman, welcome back.
Oh, it's so good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. I'm going to begin by stipulating that your work-to-do list this week is harder than mine, Congresswoman. That is a tough, list. So I'm going to dive right in with you. How likely is it that we wake up to a partial government shutdown on Friday?
The Democrats in the House and the Senate and President Biden are not going to let a shutdown government. That's simply not acceptable. So we have certain basic responsibilities as a government, and it is just such a dereliction of duty that Republicans are refusing to do the basics of our job. But we have to ensure, coming out of this pandemic, as businesses and vendors that do business with the federal government, employees, everyone who is looking for signs of stability and progress and opportunity, it is irresponsible to let us shut down in the best of times. And these are the worst of times.
So whatever it takes, not going to happen.
We will find a way. Okay. That is right.
Okay. So on that front, and you know, what's interesting about watching this from afar, Congresswoman, is all the linking of different things. So my understanding is that the blocking yesterday had to do with linking extending funding of the government past September 30th with raising the debt ceiling. Those are two separate things, but they're usually treated as related. Do you have to de-link those, get one done first, which is extending government spending past September 30th, and then pick up on the question of the debt ceiling? And I ask because I understand that even concerns about our ability to raise the debt ceiling could lead to dire financial consequences for the government's credit rating, the faith in the U.S. government, et cetera.
Yeah, the Republican Party has backed the American people and our full faith and credit into this position. So, yes, we do have to de-link them because Republicans have said that they will not do them together. So we are going to take this one crisis deadline at a time. And if the Republicans will not help, which they clearly have demonstrated they won't, we will make sure government stays open first, and then we will make sure that we pay our past bills. And I really think we need to pause for a minute and think about what that message is. These are not, you know, these are credit card bills. These are debts already incurred. And the Republicans are trying to link it to future spending, which has all been paid for, by the way, and will not increase any of our debt. But they're trying a very misleading political strategy at a time when the American people need all of us to come together and be looking out for them.
So there's so much in there, Congresswoman. And yeah. I want to pick up on the different pieces. Okay, so for the listeners, reminder, there are, it appears, let me backtrack, I'll do this. It appears that the fight over the debt ceiling and government spending after September 30th is really a proxy fight for the fight over the two infrastructure packages, the smaller bipartisan roads and bridges, $1 trillion bill, and the larger $3.5 trillion social infrastructure spending package that the Democratic Party intends to put through on party lines through a reconciliation process. Is it fair to say that the one is a proxy fight over the other?
You know, I don't know how to characterize the Republicans' irresponsibility as a proxy. I think what you are seeing with the debt ceiling is that they continue when they are in power. They make sure that this gets done. You know, we have quotes from Kevin McCarthy saying, this is a core responsibility. And yet now they are using this as a political football. And I think there probably is some connection to the infrastructure in their minds, and that they are trying to conflate for the American people our past debts with future spending. But all of it is beyond cynical. It is destructive. And what we are saying as Democrats is we're going to do both things. We are going to pay our past debts, as we helped them do when Donald Trump was president and they held the majorities. We are going to keep our government open and functioning. And we are going to pass President Biden's Build Back Better agenda, because it is the agenda of the American people.
So let's stay there for a second, Congresswoman, because you're expressing great confidence. There are fights inside the Democratic Party itself between moderate Democrats and the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party over that $3.5 trillion spending package. Is it too big? And perhaps over the tax increases that are in it that you're citing as the way that it will be paid for. You're expressing great confidence here, but I heard Speaker Pelosi on George Stephanopoulos on Sunday talk about, yeah, that number's probably going to have to come down. We heard Speaker Pelosi last night say we're going to vote on the $1 trillion package this week, when originally the plan was those two go forward together. So to the voters of Massachusetts who are watching this, and that looks like shaky ground inside the Democratic Party, why do you have such confidence that this is actually going to happen?
Because I am talking to our membership and the people of my district every single day. And I can tell you that the meetings we have had this week have, I was optimistic coming into this. The analogy I can think of is, you're taking off, there is a lot of turbulence, and then you break through the clouds. And that's where we are. We're in the turbulence on how, but we are so clear on why we are here, why this is important to the American people, that we not only make these investments in our roads and bridges, in getting lead out of our water, in broadband, but also in them, that we have the ability for families to access home care and child care, that we address the high cost of college, that we make sure that every person can access affordable health care, and that those investments go hand in hand. And this pandemic has stripped out all the pretense we have, and it's shown us there is one way forward: investing in our people, seeing the American people, whether they're in rural America or living in our cities, and making sure that everyone has a chance to be included in this Build Back Better agenda and in this economy of the future. And what we have, how deep the cynicism is, we have Kevin McCarthy, after trying to get an infrastructure bill passed for 4 years under Donald Trump, now whipping his caucus against even the bipartisan agreement because they keep putting politics over people.
So that's a great chance to then ask two follow-up questions. The first, you know, I as you've been laying out sort of your confidence in what will get done, and your expressed frustrations about sort of blocking from Republicans, there are some pretty core safety and human issues here. You know, if the government does shut down September 30th, furloughs could hit 62% of employees at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, according to Reuters, for example. Are you hearing, so in back rooms, are you hearing, without naming names, anybody on the Republican side or more from moderate Democrats saying, we all want to come to the table, give us a way to do this? Or is it as nasty in the back halls as this fight looks like it is in the front halls?
So I can tell you what I hear and see from my Democratic colleagues. That is unity around this purpose. And we may not have every T crossed and I dotted on how, but our why is so very clear. And it's not a question of if, but how we get this done for the American people. And some of those backroom conversations with Republicans, I know they agree with us. They hear from their constituents too, how painful it is to sell the only family asset, that family home, because it's the only way to get care for your aging parents. That women are being driven out of our economy at record-breaking numbers because they lack child care. These issues are not red or blue state issues. They are every state issue. What is so discouraging and dangerous about the time that we're in is the willingness of the GOP to put those very real concerns behind to score a political win. And as Democrats, we can regret it, we can bemoan it, but we cannot let that stop us from getting this done for the American people.
And what about the pushback, Congresswoman, that Democrats are also playing brinksmanship with the assertive linking of the $3.5 trillion spending package, which is not bipartisan, with the $1 trillion roads and bridges bill? I mean, that's a strategy. We spent the whole summer talking to members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation saying these have to be done and they have to be done together. What about the pushback that is brinksmanship as well?
This is one agenda. It is one agenda born out of the concerns of families sitting around their kitchen tables. This is their fears and their dreams for a better future. We have this incredible opportunity coming out of a year and a half of just unprecedented loss and sorrow and fear to not only move us forward, making those core investments in infrastructure, but making sure that everybody, the better part of the Build Back Better agenda, is that everybody is included and can see themselves in this blueprint for our future economy. And so these do go together. And we can, you know, there's lots of stories that sort of get wrapped around the process spokes, but we have to be clear. This is why we're here. This is why we have the majorities, however slim they may be, because the American people know the importance of this moment, and we are not going to fail them.
In the last couple minutes we have with you, I do want to shift gears for a minute, because I want to ask you about the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which essentially died during negotiations. You have stood in support of the Congressional Black Caucus on this bill since back in June of 2020, right after the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police and the beginning of protests in the streets that swept across the nation. How are you looking at that? I guess failure is an editorial comment, but it didn't happen. How are you looking at that? And is there hope for Massachusetts constituents that that bill comes back and gets passed in a future year?
It was devastating to see that be defeated, to be unable to get it through the Senate. Again, we are not going back. We are not giving up. We are at a moment of racial reckoning in this country, and addressing issues around policing and how it impacts communities of colors is absolutely core. We want every single kid to feel secure walking in their neighborhoods. We want every single child to be able to see themselves participating, to have in the American dream, participate in this economy. So that bill, much like our voting rights bill that have been rejected in the Senate, gun safety bills, we are going to keep going because it is so critical that we do. And we simply cannot say that didn't work out, so we're not pursuing it. We have a lot of work ahead of us. The challenges are great, but this is our moment. And so that is just so devastating that the Senate rejected it. But we are not going to take no for an answer from Republicans. We will be back.
So somewhere in the 5th Congressional District is a constituent who's going to sit down at their kitchen table tonight and sort of play out for themselves that meme that we've all been playing out where 2021 was supposed to be better than 2020, and now no one can wait for it to be over. And they're tired and they're frustrated and Delta is out there and they're worried about spending and money, et cetera. What is your message to that person as they plunk down at the kitchen table tonight? Something, some message of hope and a little bit of peace.
We see you. That's my message. We see you, and we are, there is an element of politics, of a legislative process that is messy and can be very disheartening, especially in these times of such political division. But I can tell you this, the Democrats in Congress are committed to meeting you and your family where they are and seeing the struggles that you have, and not just talking about them, but bringing real solutions. That is the commitment of President Biden. That is why the American people sent him to the White House. And we are not going to let you down.
All right. That is Congresswoman Catherine Clark of the 5th Massachusetts District. Congresswoman, I know it's a busy day. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Did you know that humans are not the only ones lining up and showing their arms to get vaccinated?
Do you suppose we'll meet any wild animals?
We might. Animals that eat straw?
Some, but mostly lions and tigers and bears.
Lions?
And tigers?
And bears.
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
Lions and tigers and bears.
Okay, it's actually gorillas, lions and tigers and gorillas and anteaters, but they are all on the list at Franklin Park and Stone Zoos to get vaccinated against COVID-19. The zoos, which are owned by Zoo New England, are among zoos across the country taking steps to protect their most vulnerable animals from the virus. We find this fascinating and obviously a little fun because we got to work in The Wizard of Oz. So we invited Dr. Chris Bonner, who is the senior veterinarian in Zoo New England's Animal Health Department, to join us, and he did. Dr. Bonner, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So this is fascinating. I have so many questions, Dr. Bonner, and we got a little playful there, but let's start with the business at hand. Why are you vaccinating zoo animals for COVID-19?
Okay, well, we always try to provide the highest possible level of care for all our animals here. And to do that, we want to provide the most sophisticated level of medical care. And the bedrock of good medical care is excellent preventive medicine. So as part of having a good preventive medicine protocol, we wanted to vaccinate the susceptible species for the coronavirus. And we're very fortunate that there has been a veterinary product developed by Zoetis Laboratories, and they're very generously making about 11,000 doses of that vaccine available to accredited zoos. So we're one of about 70 zoos that is participating in this program, so that we can get the species that we have here at the zoo that are sensitive to this virus vaccinated to prevent disease in them.
Okay, so a couple things. First, I just want to acknowledge for listeners, we have a little bit of a sound delay, so just acknowledging that. You said susceptible species, so that means you're telling us that there are species of animals in the zoo who can get COVID-19, and I'm assuming for whom they can get seriously ill, that this isn't just asymptomatic cases. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's been documented to cause a disease in primates. It's been documented to cause a disease in cats and in otters and related animals. And while there have been no fatalities in U.S. zoos, there have been fatalities of large cats in zoos in foreign countries. So there have been some deaths of lions and tigers in India and Pakistan and zoos there. So and with the rise of new and more virulent variants, we were very eager to get our species that are known to be sensitive to the virus vaccinated to prevent illness in them.
So, and to understand, are there any endangered species on this list where a loss of a single animal, I understand there haven't been deaths in the U.S., but there have been elsewhere, where a loss of a single animal is like a species level loss?
Oh yes. The gorillas and other apes and many other primates are endangered. So are things like, tigers, snow leopards, animals like that. So there are a lot of endangered or even critically endangered species on the list of animals that we want to vaccinate.
So, Dr. Bonner, you said a minute ago there is a veterinary product, and I do want to clarify on this. These are not vaccines that would otherwise be going to human beings while we still have a global sort of desperate need to vaccinate people. This is a vaccine that has been developed specifically for animals, right?
Yes, this was developed by Zoetis Laboratories, which is a specific manufacturer of veterinary pharmaceuticals and biologicals. And it was developed to vaccinate mink because they're extremely susceptible to this virus and have an even slightly higher mortality rate than humans do. So, yes, this is a veterinary product. It was developed similarly.
So, okay, so now I am trying to picture how you get a gorilla to get a shot. I mean, it's hard to get a kid to take a shot when they don't want one. How are zookeepers getting wild animals, big, strong, often dangerous wild animals, to take a shot?
Yes, well, fortunately, they're also very good at training. And so our zookeepers, in concert with our curator of animal behavior and our veterinary technicians, they've all worked very hard to get these animals trained.
What does that look like?
To present a shoulder, present a hip for an injection. So it's all done with positive reinforcement. So they call the animal over and have it, for a food reinforcer, for a treat. They are conditioned to put their shoulder up or put their hip up. And it's remarkable how quickly they have learned to do this. And then you start with a syringe, tapping it with your finger maybe, and then a syringe with no needle. And then you work up to a blunt needle, and then you work up to a real needle stick. And They've done fantastic. The amount of work they've done to accomplish this is really impressive.
So I'm a very snacks-oriented person. What's the range of treats? I mean, what's an otter get? What's a monkey get? What's a lion get for a treat if they sit still for their shot?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, there are lots of different treats, as you might imagine, that depending on the species. So a gorilla or other primate might want a grape or a banana slice or a piece of primate chow, whereas a lion or a tiger would want a piece of chunk horse meat or something like that. So you kind of tailor make it to what they like. Giant antlers love avocado. A giant antler will do almost anything for some avocado. So there's quite a range.
I'm loving the avocado toast image for the giant anteater. I think a lot of people can identify with that. Now, listen, this gives me great joy to talk about. I find zoo animals fascinating, this whole thing fascinating. There are some practical aspects to this, and I do have a couple other practical questions I want to ask you. The first is, you've used the actual word cats, right? These are zoo animals. I remember early in the pandemic, people wondering, can I pet my own dog or cat at home? And can I let someone else pet my animal? And can I give it to my house cat? And can it give it to me? if we're doing this in zoos, does that raise concern about domesticated animals and whether they need to be vaccinated?
Well, you know, that's something that the veterinary community has been following, and they have, of course, been testing domestic animals when they have come down with signs of coronavirus. There have been documented cases of dogs and cats who were in households where the humans in the household got coronavirus. And there have been documented cases where the pet animals actually did contract the virus and did shed the virus. But so far, we haven't seen a lot of morbidity and mortality in domestic animals from this virus. So while it seems to be a cause of morbidity and sometimes mortality in the exotic cats, so far that hasn't been what we've observed in the pet animals. Of course, this is something that you know, the veterinary community is going to be following very closely, because the situation is evolving with new variants and things coming out all the time. But fortunately, so far, the veterinary community has not been overwhelmed with cases of sick domestic animals from this virus.
We're talking to Dr. Chris Bonner, senior veterinarian at Zoo New England. So, Dr. Bonner, pretty much everything about the human coronavirus vaccination has become politicized. Is that true in the zoo animal world, too? Has it been controversial that you are vaccinating animals?
So far, not really. You know, we vaccinate lots of animals for lots of different things. Everything from West Nile virus, which, you know, came to this country about 20 years ago and has been a problem off and on since then, to things that we're much more accustomed to, like, you know, giving the great apes when they're young, they get their DPTs and all, just like we do. And, you know, these vaccines have never really been controversial or politicized. So the veterinary community has been pretty much right behind this right along.
Anything that you want listeners to keep in mind when they come to Stone Zoo or Franklin Park Zoo, now that they're more aware of sort of the risks to special and sometimes endangered animals around the coronavirus?
Well, we've been, you know, very careful from the very beginning of this to make sure that our procedures and policies, you know, protect the animals in our care from contracting disease. So, you know, we have mask requirements for staff and for visitors who would, you know, be indoors where our animals are. The great majority of our susceptible animals are, say, behind glass or outdoors, where the risk of transmission would be very, very low. And so, and we're about a third of the way through our vaccination, first set of vaccines, at least, here for our animals. So we've been right along being very stringent in our use of social distancing and use of masks and other PPE and vaccines for our staff and other people. So we've been right on this from the beginning, and it should be very safe and effective for everyone.
All right, so go ahead and go to the zoo and see the animals. That is Dr. Chris Bonner. He is the senior veterinarian in Zoo New England's Animal Health Department. Dr. Bonner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Booster shots are here. Yesterday, President Joe Biden answered reporter questions while he got his.
Is the First Lady getting hers as well today, Mr. President?
She's going to get one. I think she's teaching that, but she's going to get one, yes.
So boosters are being given here in Massachusetts as well, following the CDC guidance from last Friday that all folks 65 or older, those who have underlying health conditions, and those who work in professions considered to have an elevated risk of exposure should all get booster shots if they are at least 6 months removed from their second dose of the Pfizer vaccine. If you did not receive the Pfizer vaccine, you do not qualify. Meanwhile, at least 6 lawsuits have been filed here in Massachusetts seeking to overturn school mask mandates, even as the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, DESE, extended the date on its mask mandate to at least November 1st. So there is a lot to talk about. I have questions. I bet you have questions. So ask them. We're going to dive into another edition here of Ask the Doctors. Calls are already coming in. You can get in queue at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here with us to help, Dr. Sabrina Asumu, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine and Infectious Disease Specialist at Boston Medical Center, and Dr. Helen Boucher, Infectious Disease Physician at Tufts Medical Center and Interim Dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Asumu, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
And Dr. Boucher, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you. So Dr. Asumu, boosters are rolling out this week. We're also headed into fall, cooler weather, more indoor gatherings. How are you feeling about where we are in terms of this pandemic? Are you feeling hopeful, concerned, some of both?
Well, I think that the picture is very different if you're in a state like Massachusetts, Vermont, or Connecticut, where you have a high level of vaccination and a low case rate, when compared to other places in the country, such as Texas or Florida, which have lower rates of vaccination and higher case counts. So I think it's sort of a very different full picture for the country. But overall, I think we're heading in the right direction. We still need to keep vaccinating for COVID and also start thinking about vaccinating for the flu. So I also encourage you, if you haven't yet, please get your flu shot so that we don't get two epidemics at the same time.
For a second, I thought you said two academics at the same time.
Epidemics.
We have two academics here. We value you very much. So Dr. Boucher, sorry, a little punchy there. Dr. Boucher, I'll come to you and ask you, do you want to add anything to what Dr. Asumu just said, you know, in terms of sort of your level of comfort on where, comfort's the wrong word, but you understand what I'm saying, on where we are.
Yeah, no, I mean, I certainly agree with Dr. Asumu, and I feel very fortunate that we are where we are in the country. I will point out that we're not totally out of the woods yet, and there is some concern about another bump here in the Northeast as we come into the fall. So we can't let our guard down, and I think, you know, paying attention to flu vaccine, but also paying attention to the measures we have in place until we really know that it's safe to start peeling things back.
All right. I'm actually going to go straight to the phones. I have more questions, too. We'll pepper them throughout, but the calls are coming in. So 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus question. We'll start with Jonathan in Carlisle. Jonathan, you're on. Go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you. Hi there. I am curious if you could comment about exposure. I have a wedding to go to later this month, and I know some people that are coming from out of state that are not vaccinated and just concerned about, you know, the dangers, obviously, to them, but to people that are vaccinated, and if those are additional dangers for us, despite that we are vaccinated, and particularly considering that they're traveling and using air travel.
So Jonathan, just to follow up, are you asking more about whether you should go or more about how to be safe if you go?
I guess how to be safe, which would be, I would assume, common practices that we're all using. But really, you know, is the vaccinated population versus the unvaccinated population and the risks or dangers to either posed by, you know, each other? I guess it just seems to be sort of a clouded thing that's not talked about that much.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Jonathan, one last question. Indoor or outdoor wedding, just so we know?
There would be some of both.
Some of both. Okay. Dr. Asumu, can I give this one to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So number one, emphasize is, you know, if you are vaccinated, so it's a great thing that you're vaccinated. If you're vaccinated, you have a high level of protection. But as we know, the vaccines are not 100%. So we'll still recommend that, especially if you're going to be, you know, both indoors and outdoors, and there's going to be a lot of people there, that you mask at the wedding. So in terms of one thing that I'd like to emphasize is the big principles, you know, outdoors is always safer than indoors. So if you have an opportunity or a chance to pick between both, I'll spend most of my time outdoors. And, you know, you want to avoid crowds. You make a personal decision by attending the wedding, but, you know, there's just certainly certain things that you can do, such as, you know, you got vaccinated, which is great, staying as much outdoors as possible and wearing a well-fitted mask.
Okay. The next question, Dr. Boucher, I'm going to give to you, and I'm going to read it to you. Maggie from Brookline called, wasn't comfortable going on air, but had a question that I think lots of listeners would have. It's about the Pfizer booster. And the question is it the same dose as the second shot and or the first shot?
Yeah, it's a great question, Maggie. And the answer is yes. So it's either a third dose or a booster, depending on your situation. And you know, the good news is that we have data about both the safety, and I think that's the first thing to emphasize. It appears that there are probably less adverse effects or side effects with the third dose, and some effectiveness data showing that it gives a very big boost in terms of protective antibodies. So safe and effective.
So Dr. Boucher, let me just ask you to clarify. You said it's either a booster or your third dose. I know there's an important distinction there. So do you mind going ahead and clarifying what that distinction is, please?
Certainly, right. So a few weeks ago, we had the recommendation about a third dose for people with compromised immune systems and the elderly, people who wouldn't have gotten a good response or were less likely to get a good response with two doses. So in those individuals, it is a third dose to give them immunity. That's different than what we're talking about now for people like me, a healthcare worker, in whom a booster dose is now allowed with the Pfizer vaccine.
Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. We are doing Ask the Doctors with Doctors Sabrina Asumu and Helen Boucher. Megan's on the line in Watertown. Megan, go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering, for those very rare side effects from the vaccine, do you have any, if you did not get them with the first round of vaccines, does that hold true for a booster shot? Are you safer? What's the side effect likelihood?
Thank you for that question, Megan. And Dr. Asumu, I'm going to give it to you. And in addition to the more serious side effects that I think Megan's talking about, I'll add to it, you know, the icky feelings that some people got after their first doses that were short term or maybe didn't get after their first doses. Dr. Asumu.
Yeah, no, this is a great question. So far with the data that's emerging is that a lot of people seem to be experiencing a lot of the side effects that they had with the second dose, you know, with either the fevers or feeling kind of worn out. There's also been more reports of maybe some large lymph nodes. But overall, the symptoms seem to be very similar to what people had experienced with the second dose. In terms of in general, you know, you're probably thinking about like some of the more, you know, for instance, some of the myocarditis that had been reported mainly among younger men. So first of all, we're still exploring and looking at side effects, but the main thing to remember is that currently in this pandemic, the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risks. And when we looked at the totality of potential side effects that could happen from the vaccine, recommending the vaccine was definitely the way to go.
Okay, let's go back to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's pick up Rick in Middleborough. Rick, go ahead.
Hi. So I got the Pfizer vaccine, and I'm eligible for the boost now. And I would really rather get the Moderna vaccine at this point. Is there a medical reason why not, or is it just the fact that it hasn't been experimented on that way in public? And if it's not, is there a way to get on a study?
Thanks for the, and that I think is the first time we've had somebody ask about getting on a study, which is interesting. So Dr. Boucher, if you could pick up both of those parts of Rick's question.
Sure. So Rick, first and foremost, so-called mixing and matching hasn't really been studied enough that there are any recommendations we can give you. So there hasn't been any data submitted to the FDA yet looking at following Pfizer with Moderna or vice versa for that matter. It's also true that, you know, the immunity from all three vaccines is very, very good. So the recommendations we have are based on evidence, both safety and effectiveness, that lead to the recommendation to follow Pfizer with Pfizer. And indeed, the only boosters currently recommended are the Pfizer. To your question about a study, I'm not aware of a study in Boston right now looking at the mixing and matching. Dr. Asumu, are you aware of any?
No, actually, I'm not. And actually, I looked it up recently because a friend of mine was asking exactly that question. So I looked it up on the clinicaltrials.gov and looked to see if there were any sites close to Boston, but there were none actually for that specific NIH study.
And why is that not being studied more? And the reason that I asked Dr. Boucher, I'll follow back up with you here. Early on in our Ask the Doctors, as vaccines were beginning to roll out, there was actually quite a bit of conversation about whether or not over time the strategy might be, for example, to have an mRNA, but then get a booster with J&J, which is a different type of vaccine. There was a lot of conversation about that early on. So why has it shaken out like this?
Well, I think there's probably at least two reasons for this. One is that the first priority still remains to get vaccine authorized and delivered to as many people as possible around the world. And so the focus has, I think, appropriately been on taking the vaccines that we have and working down the age, you know, the age groups for children so that we can really stop the circulation of this terrible virus. At the same time, I think the work on mixing and matching is happening and starting to happen. The other issue that is somewhat of a challenge, it's certainly not insurmountable, but it is a challenge, has to do with the fact that all of these products are manufactured by different sponsor companies. And when they work together, it can get quite complex, especially if one piece of the puzzle is authorized and one isn't. So it does take a little bit longer for those types of studies to get off the ground. I think we'll get there, but appropriately, we're really focused on getting the vaccines we have to as many people as we can, as quickly as we can.
So Dr. Asumu, before I go back to the phones, I'm going to turn to you and pick up on that thread from Dr. Boucher, and I'm going to play a little sound from Governor Baker. Here he is.
The fastest path back to normalcy, the fastest path back to the life everybody wants, which is the one they had before the pandemic began, is to get more and more people vaccinated.
So we're talking about boosters, but we still have a chunk of the population not vaccinated at all. I vividly remember the first time you joined us on Ask the Doctors, and the beginning of every answer you had to every question was get vaccinated. You have been very strong on this. So once more with feeling, make your case to those who have yet to be vaccinated.
Yeah, no, so you're right. I think that the best way to get us back to the new normal is going to be to get as many people as vaccinated as possible. So getting these first shots is actually going to be really important, even though we're talking about booster shots right now. And what I'll encourage everyone's listening, you know, what I've realized even by talking to my patients or to friends is that people still have a lot of questions. There's a lot of fear. And so what I'll encourage people is, you know, talk to your healthcare professionals, reach out to your faith leader if that's who you feel most comfortable, and ask your questions so that we can, you know, answer those questions that you'll feel comfortable getting vaccinated. Because again, that is the best way that we can all get to the new normal.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Michelle in Newton. Michelle, what's your question?
Hi, Magna. Thanks so much for continuing this program. Thank you, doctors, for being here. Two questions. One is, how much data do we have so far about the efficacy of the third dose and how long this one might last? I know it's early in the process, but I know that some other countries like Israel may have published some data already. And the second question is, are there any risks associated with getting the third dose too soon? Maybe not risks in terms of detrimental effects, but maybe lost benefit in terms of, you know, is it better to wait the 8 months or should you go as soon as you're eligible in 6 months?
Okay, I'm going to give that to Dr. Boucher. And Michelle, I don't mean to embarrass you, but I got great joy out of being called Megna right there because I think she is the bomb. So I will take it. And Dr. Boucher, I have two parts to Michelle's question there, both how much does the booster shot strengthen you and, you know, are there risks of going in early for it?
Right. So great question. So in terms of efficacy data, we have a growing body of evidence. So a lot of the evidence is around antibodies and showing that the so-called neutralizing antibodies are much higher and lasting with the third dose. So that's really good. And then we have clinical data, as you mentioned, from Israel. And it is relatively short term on the order of weeks to now a few months, but it looks very, very good. And I think as you think about the science here, we know from many, many vaccines that boosting works. So, you know, there's a lot of reason to believe that this will be lasting. Of course, time is going to tell us just how lasting this is. To your second question about the risks of giving the third dose too soon, that's a very good question. And I think that again, not unsurprisingly, we've learned that giving the third dose after some time is actually the key. So allowing that time so that the immune response is ready to receive the boost is key. And so for the Pfizer, it's recommended after at least 6 months. And we'll see for the others what the recommendation is.
Thank you for that. Let's get Matt's question in Reading. Matt, fire away.
Hi, my wife had the Moderna shot. She had two. And on the second one, like 2 days later, she ended up with a frozen shoulder, which is like she can't lift her arm. The doctor probably knows what I'm talking about. I know there's no evidence of this causing it, but the doctor says they've seen it after flu shots and other vaccinations. My only question was, is there any reason why she can't get it someplace else if she ends up with a booster or a third shot, like in her hip or a thigh, or is there any reason for that? Because I asked too, because I work with my hands and I didn't really want it in my shoulder, and they said no.
Thank you. Thanks for that question. And, you know, Dr. Asumu, we do know that frozen shoulder is a thing with shots sometimes. So what is your answer to Matt there?
Yeah, no, this is a good question. And I'm actually sorry that your wife had some side effects after vaccination. Well, you know, the way that these vaccines have been studied is the way that we recommend that they are administered now. So I'm not aware of any data to suggest that we should be administering them in other places. So I would go with the recommendation from your doctor. And especially for this one, I would recommend that your wife specifically talk to her doctor to get some other additional recommendation.
Thanks. I think we'll have time to grab at least one more. Let's get Allison in Holliston. Allison, briefly, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I got vaccinated mostly because I was concerned about the risks of dying from COVID, but also because I heard a lot about long COVID. And I'm wondering if there's any data or research on the likelihood of getting long COVID from a breakthrough infection if you're vaccinated.
Thanks for that, Allison. Dr. Boucher, maybe in a minute or so?
Yeah, so it's a really important question. And so far, there are hints that there may be less risk of long COVID after being vaccinated. And so this is just another reason, I think, to put in the column of reasons to be vaccinated. And I'm very much aligned with Dr. Asumu that the number 1 through 10 thing you can do to protect yourself and your family is to get vaccinated if you haven't already.
Okay, I don't think we have time to go back to the phones, so I'm going to do a quick lightning round with the two of you. Dr. Asumu, what's the thing, the data, you are most paying attention to for the next couple of weeks?
Oh, that's a really good question. Well, you know, the schools have been opening around the country, and we also have the Delta variant. And so in terms of seeing, you know, which direction are the case numbers going to go as we have more children who are in school and with the fall coming along. So that will be like an important one. The other big thing with the big news today is that Pfizer has submitted an application and to extend the EUA for younger children. So I'm definitely looking at that one and to see what the FDA decides and then what the advisory committee decides. I actually have a 5-year-old who would be eligible. So I'm intently monitoring everything very closely, but it will be really, so far the data is looking really good from what, it was only a press release, so we need to see things, but this will be really great to have a vaccine to protect the younger ones.
Perfect. And EUA for folks is emergency use authorization. Well, we have made our way through another Ask the Doctor. That was Dr. Sabrina Asumu, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Helen Boucher, Infectious Disease Physician at Tufts Medical Center. Thank you to both of you for getting in so many calls and giving such answers. Really appreciate it.
Thank you
for having us on.
Okay, folks, that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. That's Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.